This is Age of Treason Radio. On the White Network.
And Daddy always smiled, took me by the hand, saying someday you'll understand. Well, I'm here to tell you now that you never mother's son. You better learn it fast, you better learn it young, cause someday it never comes.
With your host, Tan Stoffel.
Ann Coulter's radical rhetoric. I had wanted to talk some more about morality and identity and how those two things are related to each other. And as it turns out, I had done a podcast that I titled Morality and Identity back toward the latter half of 2012, shortly after I had started making podcasts, because it's one of the most important topics that I had boiled things down to, and I think it's worth talking about again. But I got a little sidetracked, mainly by current events and the relation to this topic of morality and identity when I went back and looked at what I had discussed. Ann Coulter was in that podcast, and I had quoted her saying, let's see, I'm skipping a little ahead here. She said, while conservatives have been formulating carefully constructed arguments, liberals have been playing a long-term game to change the demographics of America to get an electorate more to their liking. A little bit further on, she said, there's a strange asymmetry in how this matter may be or can be discussed. Liberals and ethnic activists boast about how America would be better if it were more Latino, but no one else is allowed to say, we like the ethnic mix as it is. That would be racist. By now, no one even tries to disagree. And I didn't actually listen to my podcast last time, but my feelings really haven't changed about this. It's honest in a sense, and it's dishonest in a more important sense. It's what she says is true about identity politics. And about the same time I was doing this podcast, I either shortly before or shortly after went into what is identity politics? And just to put it in a nutshell, identity politics is the idea that every non-white group has interests and has the right and even the duty to organize to pursue those interests, but not whites. And identity politics, as it's usually seen by the left or liberals, and it really comes from Jews, is that's the divide. It's a totally different standard, and it's a moral standard that whites aren't supposed to have any sort of white organizations. That's stupid, crazy, and evil. And this is what Ann Coulter is getting at. She's pointing at this and calling it a strange asymmetry. Anyway, what's in the news is, and this has been a long time coming, and there have been many other notifications of it, but just this recently, this month, I ran into a story from California State University at Northridge. It was in their newspaper that was titled, Latinos Will Pass Whites as Majority Ethnicity in California in March. That's in their Daily Sundial. And it talks about how it's really going to be a plurality. It's not really a majority versus minority thing. It's the Latinos are projected to eclipse whites as the plurality, the largest racial/ethnic group, by a margin of 39% to 38.8% respectively. And then the thing that's notable about this article, it's a very long article, but it gives you a glimpse into the kind of dishonest, even more dishonest than Ann Coulter and more distasteful. It's the article is written by someone whose surname is Patel, which is an Indian surname. And it quotes non-white ethnic activists greeting this news that Latinos are now going to eclipse whites, and discussing it. And I won't read the whole thing, but I just wanted to mention that some of the dishonest language in here. A Pan-Africans studies chair, somebody who actually is the chairman of an academic committee at the university, agrees that the change is significant as it is a more realistic representation of global demographics. This is amazing. It's more reflective of the global society we live in, this Pan-African studies chair said. We have been conditioned to think that the white majority is normal, but if we look globally, the majority is people of color. And it's interesting that a non-white puts it in that way, that the majority of the globe is non-white. And so therefore, that's actually the norm, and that's good and right. And that's the way it should be everywhere, not just everywhere else in the globe or as the globe in total, but even in America that was formerly majority white. And this gets a little bit at the dishonest language of majority versus minority and how that's been used in the past as a thin edge of the wedge to trick whites really into ceding moral legitimacy of ourselves. That the argument basically was that as the majority, whites have a duty to look out for minorities, to protect minorities and the rights of minorities, and to make sure that they aren't abused. And we see this in what's going on in Ukraine right now, and anytime anything of any significance happens, it's usually the rhetoric is that it's the majority's duty to watch out for the minority. And this is really a Jewish thing. It comes from the Jews, and it's to serve their best interests, because they are always describing themselves as a small minority wherever they are, and that therefore their interests have to be protected. It also, the majority-minority language implicitly assumes that the majority has the power to do this, and that's tied up with the idea of how democracy is supposed to work, that the majority can vote for its own interests and outvote minorities. If there's a one man, one vote type of scheme. And as we saw when blacks took over or got the full vote in South Africa, the minute they did, they immediately voted out all the whites, or at least most of them voted blacks into power. And that's non-whites vote as a racial bloc. And even our federal court decisions in the United States have been made based on that presumption, that assumption, really. It's not a presumption. It's a known phenomena that non-whites vote as blocks like that. And it's the idea behind gerrymandering, too. That's off on a bit of a tangent from what I had wanted to talk about. Basically the idea, and there's this term people of color, too, which I've talked about before, that people of color is just a euphemism. It means non-white. It means everybody who's not white. That's what a people of color is. And it's interesting that this black, that's what Pan-African means, another euphemism, this black professor at this university imagines themselves as part of this larger identity called people of color, that they have something in common with other non-whites for the simple fact that they're not white. And it's that simple. That's what holds people of color together, is their opposition to and animosity towards whites, their distinction of themselves from whites. And the idea also, this, and it's not in this part that I just read or quoted from, but elsewhere in the article and in other articles in the same vein, the word diversity, the term diversity, and especially more diversity as being a good thing. And what more diversity means, of course, is just less white. In order to increase diversity, you have to decrease the number of whites. And this is where morality comes in, because this is a value judgment, really. It's saying that more diversity is a good thing. And that means implicitly or indirectly that less white is a good thing. And the flip side of that is that racism, quote unquote racism, which is a purely white phenomena as it's used by the current establishment, is a bad thing. And that, too, that's a value judgment, that basically if something is too white, then that's racist and it's bad. So, therefore, more diversity, less whites in American university is good. And the rationale is that it's because whites are a minority. So it's sort of a tautological circular argument there, that making whites more of a minority is good because they're already a minority, basically. Further into the article, it talks about how this is the significance of this news is that it makes the importance of ethnic studies even more urgent, and the requirement that ethnic studies be taught, you know, basically the view of politics and history from a non-white point of view is what they mean by ethnic studies. You know, positive view of the non-whites and their cultures and history, and a negative view of whites. So, you know, more diverse and more non-white implies that it's more urgent and required to have more pro-diversity indoctrination. A little further on, it says how it's important that we live in a diverse world and you want to understand the racial dynamic. And specifically about diversity, it will make a more humane citizen of the world instead of just protecting your own interests at the expense of others. That's what these ethnic studies are supposedly doing. You see how you are implicated in the system of social injustice. This is just mumbo jumbo. This is little code words of their own from their ethnic studies. This is how they justify it. And this is part of the dishonesty that I'm talking about. This, the idea that they're not just protecting their own interests at the expense of others, because that's really what this people of color rhetoric is and this Pan-African studies. It's Pan-African just means blacks promoting black interests, their own interests at the expense of others, specifically at the expense of the whites who built the university, who are the majority of the teachers there and provide the majority of the funding for the school through state taxes. And what's interesting about this statement is that it's saying basically that in order to be quote unquote successful, white people have to tolerate and understand non-whites. And this is something that non-whites complain about whites, you know, that they complain that whites expect them to understand all about the white world and white history and so forth and seeing things from a white point of view. And the answer to the problem, of course, is to just separate. Don't force people to learn about each other's cultures and interests. But that's too simple of a solution to be considered a solution. A section a little further on is titled Addressing the Individual Needs of the Latino Plurality. And interestingly enough, it actually argues that Latino is really kind of a bogus term, because the Latinos are really a very diverse group. And they point out one particular fault line that really divides the Latinos, and that is this I should just read the statement here. It says, it highlights the point that we're a very diverse group. Not all Latinos are in support of the ethnic studies or even know what it means to be a Chicano. Well, what does it mean to be a Chicano? A Chicano is that's a name that they created for themselves, or at least adopted for themselves in a positive sense. It used to be have a disparaging meaning as early as the 1920s and 1930s. But it means basically a Mexican born in America who isn't a Mexican and isn't an American, a white American, an Anglo is what they call that. It's more or less an explicit racial identity. And they have a divide, these Chicanos, who have this sense of themselves as a people separate from white Americans and also separate from Mexicans. That's more explicit than these more assimilated-minded Mexican Americans. They actually make a distinction between Chicanos and Mexican Americans. Anyway, you know, the point is that it's interesting that there the diverse suddenly loses its code meaning of less white. And they're diverse. They're trying to say, they're trying to point out that they're, that Latino is sort of a, an amalgam of many different people. And in fact, it's, multiracial. It's, gradations of, between Amerindian, pure Amerindian, all the way up to, pure European, Hispanic or Spanish, heritage, and every conceivable mix in between with a little bit of, African thrown in there as well. The Africans were absorbed into that mixed population. But despite this, right after this section talking about how they're so diverse, which you could say the same thing about whites, that whites have, you know, Italian whites and Irish whites and Anglo-Saxon whites all have their differences with each other, and German whites. There's plenty of distinction. There's plenty of diversity, really, within whites alone. We don't need to add Asians and Africans and Amerindians to the mix to increase our diversity. That only harms all of our, only harms our own interests. But the point is that right after talking about that, the article goes right back to pretending that there is a solid, Latino group that is at least has political solidarity amongst itself for, you know, winning the spoils in the political system and, organizing along those lines, but also that it's part of this, it's a subset of this people of color coalition against whites. And it talks about how, 65% of the full-time faculty at the university are white, and there's only 10% that are Latino, which leaves 25% that are something else. It doesn't specify what. And it says explicitly that the majority of the professors are white males, and a little later on talks about how 90% of the students are students of color, non-white. So only 10% of the students are white at this college, but 65% are of the faculty are white, and that includes Jews. So probably half of the 65% are actually Jews, but they don't break Jews out into a separate group. They don't identify them separately. That's part of the game where Jews pretend that they're white, and they'll get rid of all the white professors or most of them in order to reduce the number of lowercase whites to fix this supposed problem, this injustice that whites are overrepresented in the faculty and people of color are underrepresented. They actually talk about how the school serves, how that faculty serves a Latino or person, people of student of color, student body. But then their rhetoric talks about how they're traditionally underserved, the non-whites. That's part of the dishonesty too, the jumping back and forth between how they're served and how they're also underserved usually. And it's really just, this is the Jewish narrative generalized to Latinos and people of color. It's the Jewish narrative being, you know, if Jews are doing something wrong, just blame somebody else, blame white people. And this is what they're doing here. You know, the wrong is that, a country, a state, a university built by whites and still staffed and funded by whites has been overrun by an invasion, really colonization by foreign alien people. And they're complaining loudly that some wrong has been done to them. And at the very end of the article, it talks about how they need they expect resistance, but they need a dialogue. And, you know, there's really nothing to have a dialogue about. The dialogue, to the extent there was one, was had in the past. And we know how it turned out. This is how it turned out. They are taking over, not just that school, but the state, and not just that state, but America. And the only dialogue, if they were interested in one, would be, why don't you make your own schools? And then you can hire whoever you want to be the teachers. But, you know, the other point about this and the final point about this article is that there's this implicit assumption. It's fairly explicit that in order to best serve the Hispanics that are going to school there, they need more Hispanic professors. In other words, that a race of students is best served by, or a racial group, is best served by its own people teaching them. At least when it's not whites. Ann Coulter. Now, I've already mentioned that I had talked about her in a previous podcast. Lately, Ann Coulter, in the year and a half since I talked about her, she's actually been writing and several times about immigration over the last 18 months. And most recently, and back in just this February, she wrote an article titled, "Did I Move? We're Living in a Different Country Now, and I Can't Recall Moving." She has a very sarcastic tone. Ann Coulter, I used to think that she was clever when I was a conservative of the neocon variety. She seemed to me very witty. And now I find it grating because she's sarcastic about things that really don't – the sarcasm is really just a defense mechanism or a way of really denying what's the seriousness of what's going on. Anyway, she takes that kind of sarcastic tone here. "I can't recall moving. Had I wanted to live in Japan, I could have moved there. Had I wanted to live in Mexico, Pakistan, or Chechnya, I would have moved to those places too, although maybe not. They have stricter immigration policies than we do. I'm sure they're lovely, but I wanted to live in America. Now I can't. At the current rate of immigration, it won't exist anymore. The Democrats won't win elections there, so they changed it." And this is where the dishonesty comes in. You know, Ann Coulter is a professional, a pundit, political pundit, which means that she's pretending that there's this left-right, liberal, conservative, Republican-Democrat divide, and that that's the most important divide in this country. And so she pretends that when she's complaining about something, that it's the fault of the Democrats, the liberals, the leftists. And those are the terms she uses. But it's really, it reads more accurately if you just understand that what she's talking about is Jews. And she doesn't want to face that reality, but that is the reality. America was a white construct, and that's what's being destroyed. Not the buildings, the people are being displaced and dispossessed of the country that they and their forefathers built. The nation is being wrecked. Not the country, not the political parties or their principles. That's not what matters. It's the people that matter. And the non-whites understand that, and they organize to pursue their interests, and they'll vote for whichever candidate is going to promote their interests. And whites are told that that's racist. And even Ann Coulter goes along with that. And like other conservatives that are still in the mainstream, still allowed to have a soapbox to talk on, pretends that race isn't important to her. And there's a bit of cognitive dissonance here, a lot of cognitive dissonance in what she talks about, because race is right there. And she's not fooling the leftist liberal Democrats. They're all pointing at her and identifying what she's saying as racist. Why? Because they can see that she's dog whistling. She's talking about white interests without saying that she's talking about white interests. So she was at CPAC, this conservative political group that had a conference, the Conservative Political Action Conference, that was just going on this past weekend. And this is what's really in the news and what was really so radical after this year and a half or so of talking about immigration in terms like I just quoted. The first story that I ran into, and this was in isolation, but it turns out that it's linked with some other things. She says she's talking about how black people, how immigration harms black people. I mean, my whole life I've heard Republicans hate black people. She's heard it from Jews in the media. I've never seen any evidence of it until I read Marco Rubio's amnesty bill. We are the party that has always stood up for African Americans. Who gets hurt most by amnesty, by continuing these immigration policies? It is low-wage workers. It is Hispanics. It is blacks. So she's doing what she was complaining about, the asymmetry. She's expressing her displeasure with immigration by saying that it hurts black people and it hurts Hispanics. Why not just say it hurts white people? Why can't she say that? Well, she knows why she can't say it. She knew Joseph Brun, and she knows that Joseph Brun was run out of political punditry, fired literally, and died penniless and in poor health, demonized for identifying the Jewish role in all of this. She was in the same series, the same debate that she was having on a stage at CPAC when she said that. She also said that MSNBC, quote, celebrates the browning of America, but if you don't celebrate it, you're a racist. It's going to be people who are not from America who are going to be, in theory, funding older white people who are getting to their Social Security and Medicare age. I don't think that can last. At some point, they're going to say, screw it. In other words, when the Mexicans get control, they're going to cut off that Social Security, which is going to be money flowing from them to whites, something I realized 10 years ago. I used to think everything was about sex. Now I realize everything is about immigration. And this is where she really got controversial and radical. She said, amnesty is forever, and you got to vote for the Republicans one more time and just make it clear. But if you pass amnesty, that's it. It's over, and then we organize the death squads for the people who wrecked America. Death squads for the people who wrecked America. That's it's caused quite a stir. I'm surprised, really, that she hasn't been, that it hasn't been a bigger stir, and that there haven't been more prominent people saying how unacceptable it is, that kind of rhetoric. I assume it will happen over the course of the next weeks and months, and I expect that Ann Coulter will no longer be writing at the various places she's been writing. She'll be more like John Derbyshire and have to find some other job. But whatever happens to her, the dishonesty here is that it's the Democrats, the liberals, who wrecked America. And she's actually confronting the fact, I think, that it's really both parties that have wrecked America, and that it's already happened. So why are we waiting for the death squads? If she thinks that it's it demands death squads as retribution, then it should start now. As I've said on my the tagline on my blog for many years now has been, stop immigration, eject the invaders, hang the traitors. I said that before I was even racially aware. I realized that this was a betrayal of the American people, even when I really didn't focus more narrowly on the white Americans, the betrayal of white Americans. But it's clear that from her own rhetoric that Ann Coulter realizes that she identifies with whites, that whites identify with her. Her audience is white people, and that this is being destroyed by immigration. What she isn't confronting full on is the Jewish role in that. And as I always recommend in situations like this, Kevin MacDonald wrote an excellent summary titled The Jewish Involvement in Shaping America Immigration Policy, 1881 to 1965, A Historical Review. And a couple of things that are clear about that, not only laying out that this thing was a Jewish project, it wasn't Ted Kennedy, and it wasn't the Democrats, it was a Jewish project, and that it was a long-term project that started the minute they entered the country. It didn't happen after World War II. It began when they first got to America. Racist is a button that non-whites push to make whites do what they want, and whites need to realize that and stop behaving like Pavlov's dogs and blubbering apologetically the minute they hear that word. Hopefully Ann Coulter will soon.